This is Maine Currents, independent local news, views, and culture. I'm your host, Amy Brown. In celebration of Earth Week, today we'll be talking with Peter Neal of the World Ocean Observatory about his new book, The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Towards a New Hydraulic Society. Our special guest today for this Earth Week program is Peter Neal, and you're going to recognize his voice most likely because he is the host of the weekly short feature World Ocean Radio. It's aired here on Wednesday mornings at 7:30 for several years now during the Morning Maine program. And Peter Neal is the founder and director of the World Ocean Observatory. He's joining us today to talk about his new book, The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Eddie. It's great to be here.
The book, The Once and Future Ocean, is extraordinarily well researched and documented. There's 16 pages of references at the end. I went and looked. There's a whole section, and then there's 4 pages of additional reading. Very informative, thought-provoking, and it just made me wonder, how long did it take to write that? It just encompasses so many different areas of interest and so much information.
Well, you must remember that it began here, right here in this studio, in a meeting with Matt Murphy and WERU when I first came in with the idea of proposing World Ocean Radio, which is now heard all over the world. It's translated into 6 languages. And it provided for me a weekly discipline, 1,000 words a week. It's an amazing deadline. You wonder how real columnists can actually do it and do it well and consistently. And so there are, when I first put the whole manuscript together, which was a kind of amalgam of a selection of the now 385 editions that I've written for World Ocean Radio, the idea is based on the concept on which the World Ocean Observatory is created, which is that the ocean is an integrated global social system, that it's not just the place we go and see at the beach as a place apart, and we focus on it conventionally as a place for species and habitat, but it has this larger, enormous global connection, which has its natural level, it has its financial level, it has its transportation level, it has its knowledge level, it has its cultural level, it has political level, it has an economic level. And in fact, all of these things superimposed create a system that unites the world. It connects us. Everyone thinks, well, the ocean separates people, but that's not true. In fact, it's the one thing that has, from the very beginning, brought us together.
Who is the audience for this?
Everyone. Everyone is a citizen of the ocean. People ask me this all the time, and I say, look, I can't confine my audience. If it's a decision maker, if it's an interested student, if it's a teacher, if it's an activist, all of these people if they are investors and hedge fund operators, I really don't care, because this issue affects them all. That stuff that differentiates and sometimes separates us and creates conflict between us pales when you start to think about the significance of the ocean and why it matters to our future.
And your definition of the ocean is a little bit unique, and that makes it even more holistic in terms of what you're talking about, all these different layers. Do you want to talk about...
Sure. The ocean for me is the full cycle of all the systems of circulation and conveyance that are part of the ocean itself, but also that cycle that we all learn in our first science class, which is takes the ocean and the water into the air, deposits on the mountaintop, descends through the watersheds and aquifers, comes to the coast, back to the ocean, around again. So all of these circles and cycles are at work at any given time. So for me, ocean includes climate, freshwater, food, energy, health, security, trade, transportation, governance, cultural traditions, and actually individual recreation. Why do we go to the water? Why do we go to the sea when we're under stress, when we're looking for solace, when we're looking for peace and harmony? We're looking to vacate the world that is tyrannizing us. And so we go to this place, which has this unique empathetic value that touches everyone.
The way that you make the connections in this book between starting with the water, well, maybe not starting with the water cycles, but that's one of the main premises, And then getting into, as you're saying, the once and future ocean. So looking at historically some of the issues, you're looking at environment, you're looking at commerce, like you said, you're looking at your transportation, fisheries, all of these different issues. As you're pulling these things together, are you hearing from people who've read the book that they are surprised at the connections that you're making in the book? Do you think people underestimate these connections?
Oh, absolutely. To me, they're obvious, actually. I sort of am surprised by that. But on the other hand, it's true. It's real. It seems that we compartmentalize how we see things. We come at our knowledge from silos and specific disciplines. We're focused on those primarily. We actually avoid making connections a lot. And those kinds of disconnections don't necessarily make us whole as good citizens, even in the town we live in, or in the nation we're a part of, or as an international participant in global exchange. So it this unification idea, when you think about it, is just there. It's you can't really dispute it. It's just kind of a fact. From the day that the first person left ashore in a boat to go to someplace unknown, we began what we now call globalization. But it creates a process of exchange of goods and people and ideas.
That globalization that you're talking about is in the fact that what is done in one place so quickly can affect people in other places is also problematic. You talk about policy decisions and how, and with the fisheries, for instance, one country, one region, one jurisdiction tries to do something to protect a fishery or a resource, and then that isn't taken care of in another place, and the inability to get, you need the whole world to basically come together and decide on a plan, agree at least in principle, in some ways of protecting it, because one place can't solve the problems.
Well, yes, and we're working hard at this. We're clumsy at it. There's no question about it. But when you look at the ocean, it is the true commons. And so we have created a system where after 200 miles, it's free for the taking, or is it free for the sustaining?
Dumping.
Is it free for the significance that it has to our future survival? And these there are people all over the world who are trying to grapple with the specifics of these kinds of problems. And sometimes it seems insurmountable. Then sometimes you find small things where you suddenly realize, well, maybe it's not quite so difficult as it seems. Illegal, unregulated fishing, for example. We have certain nations which are the primary flags of the vessels that are breaking most of the rules in terms of unlimited taking of species in the open ocean. They are owned either by government, those vessels are owned by government, or by a very small group of people around the world. It's astonishing. I think it's 20 to 25 individuals or individual families who, through a series of flags of convenience and offshore corporations and interlocking directorates and management contracts and all the rest of it, are actually responsible for this. They can be outed. And in places like the Netherlands, where you have both sides of that equation, believe me, that sort of conversation and sometimes legal proceeding is going on. That is one of the great gifts of communications. Ian Urbina of the New York Times wrote an astonishing series on sort of illegality at sea. A team from the Associated Press yesterday won the Pulitzer Prize for a series of articles on slavery at sea.
And fisheries.
These are all things that the world wouldn't know about them. But when we do hear about them, not only do we give the investigative journalists their prize, but we also understand that that can't happen. And it's vivid. It is astonishingly vivid because it's now visualized. Mm. It's not just words anymore. You can see it right there happening. And that motivates people to say, no, enough of that. That's not the way it's supposed to be. And let's find out who's responsible. Flint, Michigan. Perfect example. You have a premeditated, ideologically driven political decision, right? And to change the source of the water for this city. And in that, one unthinking act, you destroy lives. You destroy a city. You will essentially make a huge drain on the federal budget because all of this evolves immediately, and now we know about it.
So what I think you're saying is that by the same mechanism by which an action in one place like Flint, Michigan can have huge ripple effects, pardon the pun, the other side of that coin is that the way we're connected with media these days can also have the local media, I believe, were the first to report on the Flint, Michigan water crisis, and that also had ripple effects everywhere.
Absolutely. And by the way, there are multiple pebbles dropping all over the world. I mean, we are now discovering that there are little Flints or big Flints all over the world. This lies at the heart of the book. What the book argues is that the old paradigm since the Industrial Revolution or before is over, and that is that we have had unlimited growth in the name of consumption, and it was driven by fossil fuels. But now the negative consequences overwhelm the positive benefits, and we see it everywhere. So we now have to understand that that paradigm is no longer useful and that that system must be put behind us. When you read all of the books about this, this sort of apocalyptic analysis of where we are, you can read the most liberal people, Naomi Klein and people like that. You get to the end of the book and you keep saying, what's next? And you get to that last chapter and you open it up and there's a kind of, for me, a kind of, well, terrible disappointment because there's no suggestion there as to what to do next. So what I've done is said, well, here's a new paradigm. If it's not the one you want, have a better one. That's fine. But for now, let's look at the new one, which is managed growth in the name of sustainability and enabled by water, this one thing that every one of us needs in equal amounts every day, no matter who we are, where we are, how rich we are, what color we are, where we come from. It doesn't matter. And so that underneath all of this is this terrible competition for water, which remains unspoken. And what I'm arguing for is that we turn that around and we say, okay, we don't need oil. We actually don't need diamonds. We don't need uranium. What we do need, though, is water. And once you agree to that, once you acknowledge that inalienable fact, then things change immediately and authentically. So that the way we start then to value things becomes different. The way we start to organize ourselves becomes different. The way we start to behave becomes different. And those things are not revolutionary changes, they're obvious behaviors. There are obvious things for we can do, and we can do it now with the existing technology that we have available today. We don't have to wait for some great new invention, some lightning bolt to fly out of the sky that's going to make it all better. No. It's our responsibility. It's like many things in our lives. In the end, we can postpone them and deny them, but in the end, we're the only people who can heal them.
Do you think that climate change is the biggest threat the oceans face presently?
Well, it underlines everything. I always talk about this in the sense of, you know, this debate about whether it's real or whether we're responsible for it, whether it's false, whether it would have happened anyway. All of that is sort of irrelevant. We have measurement after measurement, observation about observation about the changes that we're facing. And what you find in our political distress is essentially either an expression of vested interest or fear of change. Those are the two underlying things that are keeping us from actually going forward. So I use this all the time. This is the question that I ask the deniers or not. I say, look, what if you're right? Well, we wouldn't have done anything necessarily destructive. But what if you're wrong? We will then have done something incredibly destructive two ways. One, we will have destroyed, and two, we will have lost the opportunity to survive by changing behaviors. And so sea level is changing. We see it. We can see it in our communities. You can see it in a lifetime. I can see it in my lifetime in certain places where places I knew at one time in life are now submerged. They're gone. Or banks on shorelines that have been eroded. That's not just extreme weather. That's a demonstrable, measurable phenomenon. So why don't we do something about it? And we can. The Climate Change Institute up at the University of Maine, run by Dr. Paul Majewski, I went to a workshop there, and we had town planners from Stonington and Ellsworth and all these local communities, and we looked at their climate analysis and how it played out on specific places in Maine along the coast. And then we broke out in the afternoon, and we became the planning committee of those towns, hypothetically, and we looked at what could be changed right now that would protect in the future against some kind of damage, inundation, or problem that could be would result from these new examples of extreme weather and rain and storm and runoff and all of these things that we're seeing over and over and over again in all these places.
In addition to the rising water levels, the other thing that we hear a lot about is the change in the species, the fluctuation in species. We've been hearing for years from local fishermen about different species they're seeing here in the Gulf of Maine that they hadn't seen before. Also, ocean acidification, which is relatively new, something that's being talked about. Can you say a little bit about the impact of and how that works?
Well, ocean acidification is the great problem. It's the most invisible, and it's the most destructive, and it's the most difficult to fix. CO2 emissions changes the acid base, the pH of the ocean. That then begins to essentially affect the water column. Things move, things don't survive, and that change descends all the way down the food chain, all the way down to the most microscopic organism on which all the rest of it, including us, must depend. Species move offshore, species move inshore. Seaweed, an issue in Maine. Their habitats, because of seaweed harvest, indiscriminate, inappropriate seaweed harvest, are upset and ruined. So those incubating functions.
You're talking about the industrial rockweed harvest.
Yeah, rockweed. Yeah. Well, that disruption of habitat has a huge, huge impact on not just the animals themselves, but on the communities and the families who are essentially living as part of the process that gathers that protein together and provides it to us on the table. At the same time, you have these circulation issues. I was just in the Galapagos, you know, the place where it's supposed to be perfect because all of the nutrients by virtue of the currents over time were come together in the Galapagos, and therefore you have this perfect environment for all these animals. Not really true. They are already seeing a severe decline in many, 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 many species. Why? Because the toxins can be distributed just as fast and efficiently as the nutrients. So here comes the good, but now right along with it, neck and neck, comes the bad. And that you can find in the flesh of the fish, and you can find it in the thinness of the eggs. You can find it in the declining numbers of the animals that have been there historically.
Population growth, your numbers, your predictions about how, if current trends hold, the impact that's going to have on the water cycle are pretty frightening.
Well, there are many, many different. I mean, first of all, 7 to 9 billion, 11 billion, you read it, many, many different numbers. You know, population growth is a huge thing that is confronting the world in almost every aspect of its being. There are only three ways to deal with it: war, pestilence, and discipline. And all of them are troublesome, to say the least. So I have to say, look, I can't solve that problem. I want to look at all the other things that can be done that can increase the productivity of what we already have. So, for example, there's only of the fresh water on Earth, it's 3% of all the water on Earth is fresh. 2%, two of those percentages, are in the two poles. So 7 billion people today are living on 1% of the water, fresh, on Earth. Well, we can do better than that. There is a way that we can increase that. We can increase it by conservation. We can increase it by changing our behaviors where we become less water intensive. We can do it by desalinating salt water, which is already happening. Saudi Arabia is almost 100% salt desalinated water.
Israel has a huge plant.
Australia, New Zealand, Florida. There's a big new plant
now
in
San Diego.
Right. So you're sitting here saying, let's get real here. Now, oh, well, you can't do it. Oh, it's going to cost. No. The technology has been there for years. Why haven't these plants been allowed to go forward? Cheap oil. Now, you could say, well, the paradox, we have cheap oil now. No, we have cheap oil now because we have so much oil and we've learned how little more of it we need. We can continue to recover from the recession. We can build new economies and we can jump over this sort of evolutionary strategy evinced by fracking. You know, fracking was going to be the transition to peak oil. So it was going to prolong the ability. And what it did was it created enormous negative impacts, destroying agricultural lands, disrupting communities, poisoning that 1% of water in its byproduct, which is now seeping into the aquifers and poisoning more water. That water cannot be reclaimed. It's been deducted from the 1%. So you sit there and you realize that there are a whole lot of things that we could do differently if we just pushed that old oil paradigm away.
Desalinization plants raise concerns about the industrialization of water, the commodification of water. If that becomes the shining hope for people that we'll be able to have more of these desalination plants, like in Southern California, they're starting to do that, then you are reliant on a corporation which presumably is using some kind of energy to desalinate the water.
Well, let's talk about the commodification. There's a piece in the book about water as an asset class. Believe me, the smart money is already there.
And your quote from the Citicorp executive is really frightening.
It is totally frightening. And that's 5 or 6, 8 years old, where this is a memorandum to the insider investors. You know, Coke and Pepsi make more money from their water business, make more profit from their water business than they do from their soda business. We have corporations, multinational corporations that
like
are essentially
Nestle in Southern Maine,
but Nestle is also in Oregon. It's also in Europe. It's also all over the world, consolidating all of its control of these water. Now, in every one of these places, more and more frequently, people are saying, no, enough. And underneath that is something that I talk about in the book, which is essentially the World Water Manifesto. And the World Water Manifesto says that basically everyone on Earth is entitled to a fundamental quota of water that allows for them to survive. So let's say it's 40 gallons. Those 40 gallons would be for your cooking and your washing and your this, that, and the other thing. And those everybody gets. Okay. Now, if you want to do more, then price it accordingly, change your valuation system, and if you want to irrigate your golf course, if you want to fill your swimming pool, you pay for it. This brings us to the so-called externalities of water. I say this all the time. When I walk down the aisle of my supermarket, I hear a cascade of water. And what is that? It's all the water that's in the processing, all the water's in the packaging. Those things don't actually get necessarily put into the price of the thing because in many cases that water is subsidized. That water can even be free. So the manufacturer doesn't have to calculate it in his sticker price. Well, if we suddenly said, no, we're aware of that. We don't need these products. We can reject something that is water intensive in its making. We can change how we package things. We can change how we irrigate and grow things. And you see bits and pieces of this shifting all over the United States and, by the way, all over the world. And in some places, like Africa, you have this incredible opportunity. We should learn from their opportunity, which is they don't have to go back and rebuild the old infrastructure. They can just be on. They don't have to build telephone poles because they can go cellular from the get-go. They can go solar from the get-go. They can begin to essentially build a system that is valuable and effective and utilitarian in the 21st century that just leaves all that other stuff behind.
So the Citicorp exec was basically saying that there's not really a right to water, that it should be commodified in every way possible.
Well, that's a predictable attitude by somebody who sits in the heart of Wall Street. That's true. But there are many, many people who don't agree with him. And there are many, many people who are looking at their investment portfolios with new and better sustainability criteria. So they make investments based on social criteria, environmental criteria, political criteria, gender criteria. I mean, we see amazing that sometimes companies, for whatever reason, are suddenly into the political world in a way that we never would have thought that would have happened before, where they're actually taking stands on social issues that seemed inconceivable until just recently. Mm. So I find all of this kind of encouraging. I thought this particular gentleman was antediluvian, but it was a wonderful expression of exactly what we confront.
You preface your chapter on solutions with a section called Why We Need a New Way of Thinking. Can you say a little bit about the new way of thinking?
Well, it comes back to the paradigm. And that's the essence. That's the essence of it. And so this idea that there are three parts. One is not unlimited growth, but managed growth. Not consumption, but sustainability. Not fossil fuels, but water. And that new way of thinking, as I've argued before, changes how we will behave if we can't accept it and translate our acceptance into political will and action for change. It's not going to happen from the top down. We all know that. We've seen it. It's gotten worse. It may not get better. It might, but who knows? But the way it is happening is from the bottom up. And there are myriad examples of individuals. We posted a piece the other day on the World Ocean Observatory site about a man who'd cleaned 100 miles of river by himself.
You also had one that was just posted a few days ago about the public trust doctrine. Do you want to mention that?
Well, if you haven't known about the Children's Trust, last week's World Ocean Radio, I think it was this morning, actually, was about this. This is an astonishing thing for me because while I was writing this book, I kept saying, well, what's the legal justification? How are we going to enforce this idea? Is there any foundation on which we can base this new idea, this theory? Well, guess what? There is this thing called the public trust doctrine. It's actually expressed in our Constitution, which says that natural resources in the United States are owned by the people. And government, as trustee, has the right to license the exploitation of those resources, but only in the context of their sustainability for the ensuing generation. Now, this has been used in the Supreme Court decisions that upheld the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Environmental Protection Agency, but over the last 10 or 15 years, bit by bit, clause by clause, incentive by incentive, campaign contribution by campaign contribution, that has been taken away. We now are in a position where government has abandoned its role as trustee. Well, in the public trust doctrine, we have a recourse in the courts. Our Children's Trust is this organization in Portland, Oregon, and they have brought suits in all 50 states and in federal court, essentially suing the government to accept its role as trustee and redress its errors in the management of our natural portfolio. And the astonishing thing about this is that all of the plaintiffs are under 18 years of age. So you have our children saying, enough, thank you. We are not going to stand for something that actually is an inherent right by law. By law. And yet we have allowed it. We've subsidized it. I mean, when you look at the subsidies that have been public subsidies that go into the oil business in all its manifestations in terms of loopholes and grants for research and development, exceptions of this and tariffs, preferences, and all this other stuff that we can do, right? Take a look at the output. And there's a terrible symmetry between what the public invests in these companies and what those companies pay out to their shareholders. That is an astonishing misappropriation of public value. I think eventually history will show this as a terrible, terrible crime against the people of the United States.
We have just about 3 minutes left of the program, and I don't know how much of it we'll be able to get through, but I'd like to close by having you read some of your Citizens of the Ocean Pledge. We're looking at page 257, and we'll give the website at the end. People can follow up and actually not only hear the archives of your short features, but you also have the transcripts up there. So if people want to learn more about what we were just talking about, the public trust doctrine, that's there. But let's, if you don't mind, read a little bit from the Citizens of the Ocean Pledge.
People ask me all the time, well, what can I do? What can I do? This is so big. What can I do? Well, here are a few things. Consume at home and in restaurants seafood clearly labeled as sustainable harvest or raised. Advocate to suppliers, markets, and chefs the only such product be distributed or serviced. I am a pain in the tail at our local supermarket proprietor. I am constantly asking him why he cannot put better fish, higher quality, sustainable fish in the fish counter. To refuse plastic containers and to only choose those that can be reused or recycled. To avoid all products using non-biodegradable packaging, styrofoam, and plastic wrap. To conserve, harvest, and recycle fresh water whenever possible, at home, at work, at organizations with which I am associated. Turn the tap off. Do my best to reduce dependence on fossil fuels and production of CO2 emissions. I will endeavor to reduce my personal annual consumption by 25%. To adopt alternative technologies, more fuel-efficient hybrids, electric vehicles, solar, wind, whatever possible. These things are not so unaffordable anymore. And you see it more and more and more where people understand, I have solar panels on my house. The payback is pretty amazing. Now, you have to make the investment. That's true. But the fact is, it does pay back fairly quickly. Advocate against the use and runoff. We're going to run out of time.
We are out of time, unfortunately. But you can read this, and I would leave people wanting more. You can read this in the book, The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society by Peter Neal. Thanks again for coming in today.
It's a great pleasure. So, I love WERU.
So many things that we didn't actually get to, yeah. But the book is out there if you want to check it out.
Well, and the books are available locally at Blue Hill Books.
All right.
So patronize your local independent bookstore.
Okay. Again, the book is The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society by Peter Neal. And you can catch his short feature, World Ocean Radio, here on WERU every Wednesday morning during Morning Main at 7:30. They're also archived at the website worldoceanobservatory.org, where there is a ton of information about everything that we've talked about today. I'm Amy Brown. Join us here every Wednesday afternoon at 4 for Maine Currents, independent local news, views, and culture.